Hey, it's Bantam, and this is the Digital Song Podcast. It's time to hack destiny. Chapter 9, Wicked Hearts. Easton.
All members who indicated their attendance tonight have arrived.
Song's voice seemed muted and quiet in the office.
Wonderful,
Easton said to Song as he beheld himself in his office mirror. His outfit accentuated the athletic attributes of his physique. He wore a wine dark indigo jacket with subtle geometric patterns in the fabric, the Pyramid Club pin fastened to the black lapel near the top of his pectorals. His crisp white shirt beneath the jacket seemed to gleam. With a deep exhale, he tugged his lapels downward, spun on his heels, and strode from his chamber. When he stepped through the door into the reception hall, the crowd hummed with conversation against the background music of trip-hop and vapor house. Easton recognized most of the members, but when he forgot a face, he could use unique functionality in his branch to remember. When he forgot something, like a name, he could blink his thought-lock code into his mind. Look at the person whose face he forgot, and his or name would shoot to the surface of his conscious mind like a buoy released after being dragged deep below the surface of water. This retrieval function was but one of the special technical capabilities of Easton's branch, facilitated by integration with Song. When Branch was released, to learn more about its technology, Easton had installed Song in his UD to evaluate it. After months of analysis, Song discovered a thought lock bypass, allowing the AI to interface with Easton's branch. Eventually, by manipulating the branch cell bots pumping through Easton's brain, Song could communicate with Easton so he would hear Song mentally. Even more, Song could use the cell bots to trigger specific neural pathways to fire in Easton's brain, causing him to visualize images, hear sounds, or remember forgotten names. A woman with milk chocolate skin shining beneath her diamond and gold chain strutted over to him. Fabric connected her forearms to her flanks like wings on her eggshell jumpsuit, and the weightless cloth oscillated with her every gesticulation. Thick rows of braids originated on the top of her head, splitting at her crown and running down and over each shoulder. As soon as Easton began to think that he could not remember her, recognition pixelated in his mind.
Ramaya Dennison. Energy, desalinization, chip miniaturization and production.
Good evening, Easton,
she said.
And to you, Ramaya.
You're a wonderful host.
He nodded.
Thank you. Glad you're here.
She walked past him into the crowd. The elite techno-class patrons of the club, dressed in varying degrees of sartorial elegance, churned in the hall. This hyper-rich class were the few humans who had achieved affluence comparable only to old mythological gods like Zeus and Hera on Olympus, or the antagonists of dystopian cyberpunk science fiction like the Tessier-Ashpool family on Villa Straylight. Easton was scanning the room, taking a mental tally of attendees, when LaDonna Chambers swaggered into the reception hall. They locked eyes and Easton smiled at her, and she saluted him with two fingers before striking up a conversation with another patron.
She doesn't know that I exploited vulnerabilities in Branch.
Easton noticed Camille Sandeni standing at a bar top table holding a luminescent caramel drink with a petal of lemon zest and a giant clear glowing bubble of ice. She was chatting with a young blonde woman and a man dressed in a traditional tuxedo. The man, Brax Holland, was a young entrepreneur and playboy. Brax, only 26 years old, attained his success at 22 when he invented and patented DeepCert, a virtually unfakeable and tamper-proof proprietary code embedded in media. The technology was a digital watermark, anti-theft dye pack for photos and videos, and creator's signature at the same time. DeepCert code generated for each media file would be immutably written in a blockchain registry to prove ownership, and any copied, doctored, or stolen images would become visibly tainted as to render them unusable to fraudsters. The club had provided seed funding to DeepCert, so when Apple, Samsung, and Arbor incorporated the code into their hardware, Holland had become insanely rich, and the club shared in that profit. The blonde woman with Holland was Nadine Aden, a professional influencer on the Big Social's turned marketing CEO, whose branding and social media acumen became widely sought after during the 2020s. When she transitioned from influencer to data broker, her wealth bloomed. Sandini, Holland, and Aden were engaged in ebullient discussion, which triggered spikes of elation for Easton. The club was achieving its business purpose of connecting the powerful and the hyper-rich. Any ideas or products born of these discussions would generate tremendous financial gains once the Pyramid Club invested in them. The result would be more resources to fund the development of Song. A server weaving through the crowd with a tray of champagne flutes offered one to Easton, who, with a thanks, took the stem of the elegant glass before engaging a group of patrons next to him.
"Easton, great to see you,"
said Eric Romstaller, appearing out of nowhere. His erratic gesture turned the effervescent liquid in his champagne flute into a tiny torrent. Romstaller was a clean-shaven, tall man in his early 60s, with medium-length, wavy silver hair pulled back behind his ears. He wore a tailored suit with a red velvet necktie which punched color into his otherwise old-school style. Before greeting Easton, Romstaller had been conversing with Mikhail Fodor and Christina Da Costa. Fodor wore a fully black suit and tie combination, while Da Costa, whose hair was elegantly formed into a shape that resembled a small beehive on her head, wore a ruby-red dress, stilettos, and a dazzling pearl necklace.
"Eric, it's been too long,"
Easton offered his hand. Romstaller grabbed the middle of Easton's forearm instead of giving him a handshake, catching Easton by surprise.
"I was just talking to Mickey and Christina here about Pyramid's ROI. It's pretty fucking epic,"
he said loudly. Easton maintained his patient demeanor, trying not to display his contempt for the man and his crassness.
"I'm pleased. We've done well,"
Easton responded, tight-lipped. Everyone nodded, except Romstaller, whose attention was intensely focused on Easton.
"We were thinking, holy shit, this investment shop can't lose. I mean, I made some pretty serious gains when I was in finance, but I never had a winning streak like we have here. I don't have to tell you where the blood flows when I see my portfolio's performance."
His laugh was deep and booming, and he swung his unoccupied hand onto Fodor's shoulder, who chuckled softly.
"Oh, Eric,"
Da Costa said, feigning disapproval, shaking her head and smiling as she leaned over and touched Romstaller's arm. Before Easton could respond, Romstaller continued speaking intransigently without the slightest self-awareness of his strident manner.
"Hey, we're members of the Pyramid Club, aren't we? We were vetted, right? You should tell us some of the ingredients that make up your secret sauce. Your team of analysts are varsity for sure. What kind of predictive models or algorithms are they using? What's your suite of technical analysis tools look like? Where are you getting these tips?"
Faking a jocular baritone and emulating Romstaller's booming voice, Easton said,
"Well, if I told you, I'd have to kill you."
For a microsecond, Romstaller's face contorted into an expression of rage before his mouth expanded into a smile, pronounced chin jutting out. He roared laughing and grabbed Easton's forearm again.
"Not if I kill you first, you crazy fuck!"
Romstaller's comically loud laugh drowned out those of Da Costa and Fodor.
"The worst part about running the club,"
Easton thought,
"is having to cater to some vainglorious and arrogant morons."
Before Easton could escape from the group, Da Costa spoke up.
"What can we expect from the performance tonight? I'm excited to see what Compass Rose will play for us."
Before Easton could answer, Romstaller snatched the reins of the conversation.
"Their rendition of that throwback song Wicked Games? Not the Weeknd's classic, the other one, the original Chris Isaak version. It was truly fucking tremendous. Rose's voice,"
he whistled.
"She's a generational talent."
Easton grinned. He was so proud of what Rose had become and what she had overcome. The death of his brother, her father, was both a tragedy and an ironic blessing. Easton had never expected to be a father until Rose arrived on his doorstep. Mikhail Fodor angled into the conversation.
"I love that the band plays real instruments. It's so rare these days to hear artists who don't just craft music on a computer. Expert musicians with actual instruments that generate sounds from strings or horns don't seem to exist anymore,
he said.
And Rose, when she sings, it somehow transports me into the future and the past.
A gong clang resonated through the fixtures of the reception hall to audibly mark the termination of cocktail hour. Most patrons, understanding the signal, walked like an urbane herd through the auditorium doors, while some climbed the stairs to the upper house balcony, taking their seats at the candlelit tables within. The auditorium hummed with the conversation of the patrons until the lights in the colorful glass chandeliers dimmed, and the holographic projectors in each table's center suddenly illuminated with bright, translucent, three-dimensional representations of the Pyramid Club symbol.
Welcome members unto November 2039's Pyramid Club event,
said the deep voice of Song.
Tonight, Pyramid Club members will be presented with several investment opportunities to consider. Please enjoy tonight's dinner, which will correspond to the courses each of you chose through your Song program Leaf devices before your arrival. Each presentation will be broken into three segments. First, a factual summary and breakdown of the investment opportunity. Second, contextual research gathered by the analytics team. And finally, predictive models showing potential ROI and risk profiles for each project. As you know, the process of investing requires a commitment of Song tokens,
Song continued, referring to the club's native cryptocurrency.
The proportion of Song tokens ultimately committed will be correspondent to your stake in the venture, compared to the investments of all other stakeholders. The presentations will take approximately 25 minutes each, totaling 75 minutes. The musical performance will commence approximately 5 minutes after the conclusion of the final presentation. Make yourselves comfortable and please, enjoy.
The three-dimensional pyramid symbol floating above each table melted away. In its place, the first eye-catching presentation began to play as servers placed white square porcelain canvases of colorful works of gustatory art on the tables. Chapter 10, Born to Die, Easton. 5 minutes after the presentations finished, the lights adjusted to a crepuscular copper gold.
And now,
announced Song's deep voice,
Compass Rose.
Applause and hoots erupted as the velvet curtain that had hung down over the wooden stage's floor dragged itself open to reveal a band of four people. A pale man, wearing a slick black gold sheen suit, a gold hat, and dark shades held an upright bass. Behind him, a stubbled tan bald man in a black t-shirt, black slacks, and black dress shoes sat behind a drum set. A tall woman with dark brown skin, a sphere of curly dark hair, and a glossy blue hollow body jazz guitar in her hands stood next to a synth keyboard and soundboard. The white t-shirt under her gold leather jacket depicted the face of a cat that was simultaneously a guitar. Each musician had a microphone on a stand near where they stood. Finally, in front of a vintage vocal microphone, the singer stood in a shimmering red gown with an exposed shoulder, revealing a small tattoo below her collarbone of a compass growing out of the petals of a rose. The guitarist pressed a pedal and slid her hand up the neck of the guitar, hitting a high-pitched note. The calm but driving beat of the drum followed as the singer danced in place, swaying as if the currents of the music were pushing and pulling her. She started to sing in unison with the guitar in a melancholy alto. The hypnotic verse seemed to wash over the room. The song was Lana Del Rey's haunting ode to death, Born to Die. Even with advanced technology, the world's elite techno-class audience could relate to the music as human beings, with human failings, human urges, and human expiration dates. It was not just the front woman's voice, but her expression. She sang not only with her breath, but also with her flowing body, her grasping hands, her longing eyes, and her emotive lips. Her voice elevated to airy soprano, and her expression looked like she was bracing, trying to hold her emotion and feelings back, but the inexorable power of the song forced its way out of her lungs and heart. The song ended with a diminuendo as she sang the final lyrics. When the song concluded, the singer pulled herself from her trance, bowed slightly, and smiled a closed-mouthed smile. The sound of clapping hands, like fist-sized rain pounding a metal roof, burst from the post-song silence. From his seat, Easton pivoted his body to look around at the gallery of emotional faces, twisted in feeling. He turned back around to face the stage and caught Rose's eyes. She looked at him and smiled, and he winked back. Tears welled from seeing his niece and adopted daughter perform so magnificently.
"Do I really need to die?"
Easton thought.
"Yes,"
Song replied mentally.
"That is the only chance Rose has at surviving."
Chapter 11. Feel Love. Jason.
Red rectangle, sphere, law, crescent moon, treble clef, yellow circle.
Again, the dreams.
Jason woke with a start. His head pounded intensely from last night's booze, which had not numbed his thoughts the way he had wished. His life was an uncontrollable vehicle careening into a wall.
"Death follows me like it's perched on my shoulder in both my waking and my sleeping lives. Anton died. Rose is dead in my dreams. And now D-Rock's gone."
He had gotten the call about D-Rock while working on Mac's case at the office the day before. He stared at the ceiling until his real-life responsibilities started to creep back into his thoughts.
"I have to keep pushing forward. The hearing is this week,"
he thought.
"Is it already early December?"
The day was Sunday, and Mac's hearing had been scheduled for the upcoming Thursday. Jason's grip on reality had been slipping each day as the autumn sun rose and set, and he continued to fall into disorientation, insanity, and love. The dreams of the compass rose persisted, and Jason's cognitive barriers failed to deny them entry into his mind. He started fixating upon the dream woman whom he nicknamed Rose. He rolled over and grabbed his UD, then opened his branch app. He hoped the readout would give him insight into his devolving mental health, but the data display divulged little about the why he felt the way he did. Instead, enigmatically, Branch consistently described a feeling it detected in him as love.
"Love? Love how?"
He felt companionship with romantic partners sometimes. He felt exhilaration when he heard a not guilty verdict, or frustration and anger when the verdict came out guilty. He had loved Anton and cared for D-Rock, but now those emotions were distorted by their deaths and Jason's anger.
Was it love for Rose, or was it obsession?
His recurring nightly visions had seeped into his waking life and began to steer him toward irrational goals. He started using Branch to research strategies for remembering dreams. He scrawled daily notes about the visions and drew pictures of the compass rose and pyramid and star symbols in his small moleskin notebook that he carried in his suit jacket. He drafted timelines based on what he remembered about the order of the dreams each night, trying to discern how his brain activity and the imagery corresponded. His pen and paper attempts failed, as did Branch's advanced analytics. Branch seemed to match dream images to specific spikes or dips in brain activity, but it kept characterizing his feelings as love. After those many months of dreams, he concluded that Rose was a real person. Through twisted, irrational, subjective logic, he had determined that because the pyramid and star symbol showed up as a pin on Geo Mason's lapel in real life, the red door with the matching symbol above it must be a real place.
"Rose must be a real person,"
Jason had thought.
"If the red door and Rose are real, I can find them."
He sat up and hunched over the side of his bed, elbows on his knees, hands over his face.
"Wake up and jump into the abyss."
Jason tried to pull himself from the white-knuckle grip of the hangover, as cylinders of Sunday light streamed in through the windows. Eyes closed, Jason reflected on the events of the previous day and its hazy evening. He had worked that entire Saturday on administrative tasks in the office and reviewed Mac's case file. He sat in his office chair, swiping through documents on his Slate device, watching the recording he obtained from Sally's, and scrutinizing the body-worn camera of the officer who arrested Mac. He was scrolling through the officer's disciplinary record file when his UD vibrated. It was Tara.
Hi, Jason.
He detected a sadness in her tone, a hint of congestion as if she had been crying.
Hope your Saturday's going well. What's up?
D-Rock. D-Rock's dead.
Jason's jaw hung slack.
What? How?
Freak accident. She was walking down the sidewalk in Midtown when an AI taxi's programming malfunctioned. It swerved off the road into a crowd. D-Rock got crushed against a wall. She was heading from the office to meet someone to discuss the Darden Arbor research.
Holy fuck.
Jason's bones felt like jelly, like his muscles and flesh would slough off them. He shook his head and sighed.
I can't believe it. D-Rock's gone?
I'm sorry for the bad news. We'll know the funeral arrangements soon.
It's crazy. I was supposed to catch up with her about the Arbor research, but I never got a chance. The last time I spoke to her in person was months ago. I basically shooed her away.
Tara sniffed.
I'm so sorry, Jason. D-Rock was an incredible woman.
As anger surged through his body, Jason's voice became louder.
Why does everyone around me fucking die?
It's not on you. It's not your fault. Sometimes this is just how fate works.
Jason pounded his fists on the desk. On the other end of the line, Tara was silent as Jason breathed heavily.
Fate is like justice, supposed to net good, but it's just cold and heartless,
he thought. Tara consoled him, talking him through his frustration, sorrow, feelings of futility, until he calmed and centered himself enough to get back to work. Finally, at 6 o'clock p.m., he left his office to begin drinking, reflecting on D-Rock's fate, and searching for Rose or the red door with the pyramid symbol. The cycle of dusk fell earlier and earlier each evening in the city, as autumn died like the leaves on the trees, and the calendar marched into December. Like the sunset behind the peaks of a mountain range, the sun plummeted between the giant skyscrapers, which blocked the colorful light from hitting the streets that meandered like rivers around their bases. The tops of the grand towers above wore mandorlas of intense oranges, rosy pinks, blues, and indigos, high above the dulling colors of the streets shading into grayscale below. In early evening, Jason began his quest by sitting at the bar of a well-traveled gastropub called Thurston and Happ on Avenue A. The throngs of night people who might know about the red door with the pyramid symbol would not descend into the dark places of Manhattan until later. If Jason were going to find and save Rose, he could not be a morose or angry drunk. To counterbalance the weight of D-Rock's death on his soul, he tapped into his well of vivacity. Feigning affability and extroversion, Jason chatted with nearly everyone who ventured within 3 or 4 feet of him, all while he consumed his favorite caramel dram at the same rate that a storm sewer at the base of a hill drinks water during a heavy rain. Within minutes of each conversation, he told his new acquaintances about how someone had mentioned a venue with a red door and a pyramid symbol above it, but no written name. When he showed them his moleskin doodles of the pyramid and star, nobody recognized it.
Like it doesn't have a name.
Did you ask your branch to search Google Root?
It's got something to do with the Illuminati, for real.
What's its handle on Instagram?
All responses were unhelpful, so after 4 or 5 bourbons, he left. Flummoxed and disenchanted, he walked the 3/4 mile to Happenstance, a basement bar with velvet rope blocking the entrance, a dance floor with glitzy decor, shelves of high-end liquors illuminated underneath by neon lights, and mosaics of tiny square mirrors on the walls. The lights and lasers whipped around from fixtures in the ceilings and structural pillars. The loud music did not deter Jason from asking random people about the red door and pyramid symbol.
Did you search the socials?
Sick concept for a bar. Maybe it's a strip club. No social media. Must be shitty.
Could be shut down.
Name's a symbol instead of a word. That's a lead. It's probably in Brooklyn.
Of all the apparently useless statements, this last comment turned out to be useful. He initially felt the red door should be in Manhattan and never considered venturing into other boroughs to search. He scribbled a note in his moleskin to continue his search in Brooklyn the weekend after Mac's hearing. Jason left happenstance with mental images of Rose pulsing in his mind in an alcohol-induced strobe.
I won't let your life end like Anton's or D-Rock's, Rose.
It was almost 2 a.m. when Jason wandered into the strip club called Effigy, which he mistook for a simple dive. He went inside and ordered a drink, and his lethargy and dysphoria kept him planted firmly in his seat at the bar, with his back facing the stage, demonstrating little interest in the topless woman moving fluidly to the sultry voice of The Weeknd, who seemed to be narrating Jason's life with his song, After Hours. Just as the barkeep handed Jason a bourbon with a large cubic ice rock, a short woman in skin-tight black jeans, a white tank top hugging her round breasts, a large Chanel bag on her shoulder, and long platinum hair that reached the small of her back, sat two seats away from Jason. She ordered a seltzer, her sternum leaning on the bar, then turned toward the stage. Jason looked over his shoulder at her, smiled flatly, and sipped his bourbon. She smiled back. He tilted his head, gazing into his glass as he swirled the clear brown golden fluid.
Why aren't you watching? Kaliza has a fire set. You're missing out.
Any indication of Jason's gregariousness evaporated, exposing his intoxication and directness.
I'm not too interested in watching the dancers,
he said.
I didn't come here for that, really. I am searching for a place in New York City, and I can't seem to find it. I got frustrated walking around without any luck, so I meandered into the nearest bar to have a drink and try to think.
He turned toward her.
It's a quest of sorts.
He smiled half-heartedly from only one side of his mouth. She tilted her head at him.
Quest.
She made a sound that was a cross between a scoff and a laugh.
What's this quest about?
She gestured air quotes with her hands as she said quest.
I'm searching for a bar or club, I think. It doesn't have a name. It has a red door with a symbol above it. The symbol is a pyramid with what looks like a star right above the pyramid's apex. That's all I know about it, to be honest. No luck so far.
He avoided mentioning D-Rock. A release of those emotions would be a wave, not a trickle, so he kept the flow imprisoned within the walls of his heart. His goal was to find and protect Rose, someone he could save from death as it followed behind him, not solicit pity or be too broken to be spoken to. The woman raised an eyebrow, wonder and amusement in her expression.
I recognize you,
she said.
You're that defense attorney who exposed the NYPD for shooting Anton Sanya.
He was my partner.
Jason sighed.
Law partner. Best friend.
You've been investigating what happened for like 5 years, and the case finally closed.
Yeah,
Jason murmured.
I'm so sorry. I can't imagine what that's like.
Her tone seemed genuine. Instead of responding, Jason finished his bourbon in a gulp and gestured to the bartender for a refill.
Is this quest related to your friend's case?
No,
Jason said.
But it's definitely consuming me the same way.
Interesting that a symbol is driving your quest,
she said. Jason fully expected her to walk away from his strange conversation starter.
I suppose it is.
Jason let out a skeptical chuckle.
Can you draw it?
Jason furrowed his brow and flipped to a crudely drawn impression of the image in his journal and pressed his finger into the page.
Here.
The woman slid closer to Jason along the bar and examined the symbol.
It's so weird,
she began, pausing to get Jason's attention.
My horoscope this month told me I would meet someone on a journey and that I would help him or.
Using the vernacular phrase for him or her.
I went to my psychic earlier this week, and she drew the card Mystic Pyramid. It had a pyramid with a bright shining sun or star over its point, and it also showed a man in front of the pyramid throwing some gold coins in front of him as he walked away. She told me that the pyramid represents fate. She said, if you receive any kind of signs of the future, You can trust them if you also seek someone else's advice.
Jason's eyes darted to his lap, then to the symbol drawn with childlike imprecision in his small journal. He scrutinized her expression. Her brownish-green eyes stared into his, and her mouth was closed. She appeared to sincerely believe that her horoscope, psychic, and tarot cards played some role in guiding her destiny. Any other time in his life, Jason would have scoffed at soothsayers and augury, but against the backdrop of the dreams dominating his mind, he found the coincidence of the tarot card having a pyramid and a star in it to be notable.
"Damn," Jason said.
"So you may think what I'm about to say is strange."
He tapped the scribble depicting the symbol in his journal.
"But I saw the symbol in a dream. I think it's a real place."
He shook his head and swigged from his tumbler. The woman touched his forearm with her soft hands, her splendid pink nail polish contrasting the blacks and whites of her outfit.
"It's not crazy. I believe you."
Her eyes widened suddenly.
"And I just realized something,"
she blurted.
"Putting together the horoscope and the tarot card, the man next to the mystic pyramid was not meant to represent me. It was meant to represent you, and maybe I'm supposed to be the person that guides you with advice."
Head tilted, Jason looked at the woman, and he was reminded of Alyssa, the last person with whom he had intimate contact. When he had met Alyssa, they had discussed fate and chance, and at the time, he rejected Alyssa's belief that life had a preset trajectory and people were unable to deviate from their vectors. But the compass rose injected doubt into his previously held belief that fate did not exist. Just then, Jason's gut told him this woman would contribute to his quest. He set his tumbler on the bar, stood up from his bar stool, and turned to face her.
"My name's Jason,"
he said.
"Corrine,"
she responded. They shook hands.
"Nice to meet you."
Corrine told Jason that she worked at Effigy and had just finished her shift, but that outside of work, her biggest passions were the arts, dancing, and music. Jason told her about his work, Anton's death, Max's case, and the Darden murder. Eventually, Corrine told Jason with certitude that everything happens for a reason. The hackneyed expression conjured his memory of Alyssa making the identical claim, and as the coincidences stacked up, he felt the idea insidiously weaseling its way into his soul. After several drinks, he glanced at his watch and realized that the hour hand had glided past the 3 and was on the way to 4. Corrine noticed Jason glancing at his watch.
"I am headed to an after-hours party at a spot that my friends told me is totally lit,"
she said.
"You should join."
Jason considered his options. The alcohol had dulled the images of the compass rose, and Corrine was gorgeous, smart, and fun.
"I'm not ready to let the compass rose back into my head by going to sleep."
He paid his tab and asked Corrine the party's location, which was a club called Disco Ardent, located in a Brooklyn neighborhood with the acronym Dumbo, down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass, close to the mouth of the East River. Through Branch, he mentally input the destination into the iTaxi app. When Corrine and Jason exited together, the A-taxi was already at the curb, waiting with eternal patience. Its clementine orange body was illuminated by streetlights, the word A-taxi emblazoned across the sides in white block letters. Jason approached the vehicle's rear passenger side door, pulled his UD out of his pocket, and held it against the terminal above the door handle. The UD chimed simultaneously with the A-taxi door terminal in a pleasant harmony, indicating he was the intended rider. He opened the door for Corrine, and she climbed in and slid across the seats as he clumsily stumbled into place. Instead of a driver, a shelf-like dashboard extended over where the driver's seat would be, covering the inner workings of the AI-powered vehicle. A voice intended to convey friendliness and warmth said, "Hello, iTaxi riders," while "Hello, Jason" scrolled horizontally across the large, flat, slate-like screen, which appeared to hover above the radio buttons and dials of the A-taxi's console. Jason selected a music playlist through his A-taxi app, and when he hit play, the song "Babylon" by David Gray played in surround sound. This A-taxi was their transport across the East River to a place they could dance and imbibe their way to the shores of dawn. In his condo in the present moment, in the throes of his headache, he sat on the edge of his bed, his mind speeding through thoughts. D-Rock had discovered more about Arbor. Then his mind cut to last night's adventure with Corrine. She had not felt the slightest doubt that Jason's dreams could be portents. He squeezed out the hazy memory of the crazy night at that bizarre establishment in Dumbo. Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.